Hello, welcome along. It is a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly podcast. Thank you so much for having a listen. My name is Dan. This is pretty much the only show in the whole world that tries to uncover all the incredible secrets that are lurking around the universe. We've got a huge guest on this week. We're talking to Ben Fogle. Now, Ben is just an incredible adventurer and an explorer. He's climbed Mount Everest, did that in 6 weeks. He's rowed across the Atlantic. Is the word rowed? I'm going to go with rowed. He's rowed or rown across the Atlantic. Anyway, he got over the Atlantic on a boat. He was the one powering it, that kind of stuff. Also, he completed the Marathon de Sable, which is a six-day marathon across an ultra-marathon across the Sahara Desert. It's an incredibly long way across one of the hottest places on the planet. Ben has completed it, and he'll be on the show later on to talk about his latest plan to try and save the world. We'll also learn about one of the most deadly plants on the planet, and we'll get a good look at the surface of the sun. That's all on the way. I've got some of your questions as well. Today they're about cheetahs and the cold. We'll do them after we catch up with Professor Pulsar and get a lesson at the smartest school outside of the solar system.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
Now, as we've been finding out, Earth scientists have some very exciting plans to send robots to Mars.
And astronauts. Well, later on.
Yes, that's right. Robots will go first. Designing robots for Mars is a big job. So today I want us to think about some of the things that robot designers will need to take into account.
Like what colour to paint it? Stripes or spots?
There are some other more important things to think about, Quark. The ExoMars key mission objective is to look for life or conditions for life.
That's fossilised organic materials, right? And gases like methane, water, or signs of water.
Signs of swimming pools. Water slides!
I really don't think they're going to find swimming pools on Mars, but I suppose anything is possible. So, as you can see, Mars robots have got a lot of work to do, and they'll be all alone up there.
So how is it going to communicate with Earth and tell us what it's found?
Communication is going to be very important, right? This will be done with satellites, but because of the distance from Mars to Earth, it can be a bit tricky. Let's put that on the board.
Communication.
Now, what else will the designers of the rovers have to think about? Let's take a look at the planet again, see if that gives us any clues.
Looks pretty chilly. You said it's much colder on Mars than on Earth. As much as minus 70 degrees at night. Oh, whatever the robot's made of, it will need to be able to work at those temperatures. It's also very dusty. That could cause problems for the instruments.
That's right. And there's radiation too, which can be an issue. Let's group those things together.
Managing in the environment.
And think about the very delicate gadgets and computer technology that the robot will use. That could be quite a challenge.
Can't someone just knit it a lovely woolly jumper to keep it warm?
Well, we'll find out more about how they plan on keeping them warm and dust-free in our next lesson. So, what else will be a design challenge? Look at the terrain again.
Well, if I was trying to get across a rocky desert like that, I'd need a vehicle with really tough wheels. You don't want a flat tyre out there. Getting around is going to be a big challenge.
Exactly.
Getting around.
That's a problem in itself. You wouldn't be able to call on a recovery truck if the robot's wheels were damaged, so the design has to be very tough. Navigation is also something to think about. The robot needs to choose its own route rather than waiting for commands from Earth. That's because of the time delay in sending signals to Mars from Earth, and also because the rover will have a better view of what's around it and any obstacles.
So how are they going to power it up? There aren't any petrol stations up there. Well, not unless they're very well hidden.
Well done, Sam. That's another factor for the designers to think about.
Powering the rover.
You can't take power sources to Mars. They'd be too bulky and possibly dangerous. So solar panels will be the way to power the robots. But there's another problem that designers will have to think about before any of these. think about how the rover will get to the surface.
Landing. Yeah, I suppose they need to get that right, or there's no point worrying about anything else.
Landing the rover.
Exactly. Earthlings have sent over 40 missions to Mars to date, and more than 50% of them have ended in failure. Problems in landing account for most of these failures. And you can imagine how devastating that is after all the work done.
To crash land before a rover has even taken one roll of its wheels? That's sad. I think landing the rover might be the most important problem of all.
Well, as you can see, there are a lot of things to think about before you even start building a rover. In our next few lessons, we'll see scientists tackle some of the problems when we go down to the robotics lab.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
Right, let's get through some of your questions then. We do this every week on the show. If you've got anything sciencey that you want answered, leave it to me. I will do all the work for you. I might even get like a proper science genius to help me out with it. All you need to do is leave it as a review for the Fun Kid Science Weekly over on the Apple Podcast Store. This is what Isolde... I hope I pronounced that right, Isolde. They are 6 years old and they want to know where cheetahs get their spots from. Well, they are born with them, Isolde. It's really that simple. They're born with them, just like you may have been born with brown or blonde hair. I was born with blonde hair, slightly ginger, which has now gone a terrible mousy brown colour. But anyway, cheetahs are born with their spots. You see, they have them for camouflage. Cheetahs live in a very grassy part of the world. Now imagine for a second all the black marks that cover grass in between the gaps where you see dirt, where maybe you see little bits of trees. Well, the spots help them blend in perfectly with those black marks. If they are the predators, it helps them sneak up and attack. But it also helps cheetah cubs stay hidden from the predators. So it works both ways, but it's there for camouflage and they are born with it. Isolde, thank you so much for the question. This one is from Katie and Ben. They're in Singapore. Amazing that you're listening to this out in Singapore and they ask this question, I'd imagine very personally. Why doesn't it ever get cold in Singapore? Did you know a couple of years ago, Singapore had their longest cold spell ever? It lasted 5 days and the temperatures got as low as 21 degrees C. 21 degrees, that's low? Apparently that's low for Singapore. 21 degrees is pretty much boiling hot here in the UK. Anyway, Singapore is hot most of the time because it lies pretty much slap bang directly on the equator, the middle of the Earth, the kind of waistband that surrounds our globe. And equatorial places are hot because the sun is always shining directly overhead. Imagine if you put something right under a lamp. It's going to be much hotter right in the middle than it is going to be on the edges. It beams the heat directly on top of them, where in other parts of the world, near the poles, so near the Arctic and near Antarctica, that's why they're icy, they're not that hot because the sun hits them from an angle, so they don't really get a lot of the heat, they don't get many of the sun's rays. But if you're in Singapore, you are directly under the sun, which is why it's pretty much hot all year round, and which is why cold for you is a positively balmy 21 degrees C. Katie and Ben, thank you so much for the question. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered on this show, you need to leave it for me as a review for the Fun Kid Science Weekly over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly. Now, schools all around the UK have been challenged to try and save the world by achieving the most zero emission miles. Now get this, over 7 days, kids from across the country, they managed a total of 5,717 zero emission miles, which would be more than you could walk to Japan. And the pupil who managed the most did over 200 in a week. Now, the adventurer and TV presenter Ben Fogle put this all together, and he's on the line to tell us more. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Dan.
Now, first off, what is a zero emission mile?
So a zero emission mile is taking that distance. So maybe your walk to school is half a mile, maybe it's 3 miles. It's taking that and trying to make it as green as possible. So if you walk that mile or those 3 miles, that is as green as you could possibly get because you're having a negative impact. You're just going with your body. In fact, it's I'd argue actually you're having a positive impact because you're improving your health, you're improving your mental health, you're going to have time to chat and to be a part of the family. family, to be closer to nature. A kind of a negative mile would be if you were in a car with a combustion engine that has a ticking engine and is using carbon fuels. But there are many other green ways. So going on a bicycle would be a greener option. Obviously, there has still been infrastructure to make that bicycle, so it's not perhaps as green as walking. So there are varying different levels. And of course, you could run, you could hop, you could skip, you could go on a pogo stick, you could go in an electric car, you could go on public transport. And of course, public transport has the economies of scale. So because there are maybe 50 people in one vehicle with a combustion engine, it has a softer impact than a car that only has the two of you. So this is how we kind of used the sliding scale of greenness. And that's why it was so impressive that the winning pupil, the winning school, managed to accumulate 208 green or zero emission miles over the course of that week. So getting to school, going to sports fixtures, going on play dates, going to see friends, going to see grandma or grandpa, all of that travel was included in the accumulation of these green miles.
You said something there that we do often forget about, and it's why walking is more green than cycling, because you've obviously had all the damage to the environment that's caused by making the actual bike. Just at the basic level, Ben, could you tell us, because we hear a lot about the fact that cars are bad for the environment, but what makes them so bad for the environment?
Well, listen, this is what I say. I've got children of my own, so I'll try to explain to you and all of your listeners exactly how I explain to my children. First of all, we have a basic infrastructure that relies on cars. Now, as much as lots of people don't like cars, as much as cars cause pollution, we can't get away from that. We require them. There are people that live too far away from the transport network, so they can't reach the bus in time. It's too far. The distances aren't quite right. So cars are a part of the fabric of our society. I don't know how many there are in Great Britain, but it's got to be millions. It has to be millions. And what we now need to do is to think, as we progress forward, we're now in 2020, as we move forward, as those cars keep being produced and cars, when I say turned over, a family decides to get a new car, we need to think about being more sensible with the next option of car. And that's why electric cars are starting to become everyday. Last year, there were 70,000 electric cars registered in the UK. That's one every 7 minutes. So a huge number of people have decided that electric cars might be more sympathetic, softer on the environment. So the footprint that we leave behind isn't as significant as if you're using what I'd call a combustion engine car. So a combustion engine car is what most of you listening will go in when you're with your parents. You use diesel or you use normal fuel from a petrol station. And what happens is, as the engine moves, you're creating immediate fumes from that vehicle. Well, an electric car still requires electricity that comes from a power station. So you are still having an impact using that car. But, and here's the key, the energy you are using is 40% green energy, or what we call renewables. So 40% of the power that is moving your car forward comes from wind turbines or solar panels or other green renewable energies. So anyway, in short, in case I've lost any of your listeners now with all of that, if you go with an electric car, you still have an impact. The car still has to be made. The car still requires electricity, which still has to be produced in a power station. So you're still having an impact on the planet. But if you compare a traditional petrol or diesel car with an electric car, the electric car has a much, much, much lower impact on the environment. And that's why I'm working with a campaign called Go Ultra Low to share with you, so that you can all go and tell mum and dad when they're thinking about changing their car, that maybe an electric car is a good idea, because a lot of people like me, so a lot of parents of all of you listening to this, are slightly fearful of electric cars. We're worried that it won't have the range. We won't be able to do the distances we need. We're worried about how we recharge it. We're worried about the original cost, you know, because the cost of electric cars has been substantially higher than combustion engine cars. But that's all changing. And in fact, this year, they're almost on par with one another. And your running costs are of course, lower, because the cost of the electricity is lower than the petrol you need. Anyway, I'm getting all complicated now in my answer, but the key, I think, is that we all need to try and reduce the footprint that we leave behind. And I don't mean the actual footprint in the mud. I mean that we just need to be slightly softer on our use of resources. And that's why we were encouraging so many kids to think about how they get to school and to other events throughout the week. And that's why we're trying to encourage parents to think about going electric.
Your Hero to Zero Emission Miles Challenge, it did a bit of what you've done there, didn't it? It ran in conjunction with lesson plans in school. So you weren't just saying, look, everyone, you need to walk to school, cycle if you can. You were teaching people about this. What else were you teaching? As well as what you've just talked so fantastically about, what else can we do to help this thing?
Well, the Go Ultra Low campaign is specifically focusing on raising awareness of electric vehicles and the fact that they're not just a fad. It's not just a short trend that will come and go. This is something that is going to become complete normality. Electric cars will be a thing that they will be commonplace within the next few years. They're already all over. Part of this campaign is to try and dismiss some of the myths. A lot of people are worried there won't be enough places to charge the car, and that the power grid won't be able to sustain all of those cars. Well, the government is thinking about all of this, and they have all of that in place as the market for electric cars grows. But in terms of what the Hero to Zero Emission Miles Challenge also demonstrated, I think, to pupils, to kids all up and down the country, is how simple it is to change our habits. Now, our habits might mean that normally we wake up and we give ourselves just enough time to get into the car, to race to school, to jump out while the engine's still turning so that mum and dad could then race to their work and get there exactly on time. And a lot of people are time poor. We live in a really, really fast-paced world. But I think what we can learn from this is that if we slow down a little bit, and I'm preaching to the converted already, because all your listeners won't have the haste of mum and dad. I'm sure you've all seen mum and dad racing around. Come on, get your shoes on, get out the door. And I do that with my own children. But actually, if we give ourselves a little bit more time, if we get up a little bit earlier in the morning, we can actually change those habits. And with the simple act of walking to school rather than driving, and I'm aware lots of people can't do that, and I wouldn't want to give false hopes to those listening who have a 25 mile round trip to school, that which a lot of people will have. But if you live in a city, if you live in a town close to your school, which would be a 5 minute car journey, that might be a 25 minute walk. But what a beautiful walk that is. You get to take in your surroundings. You can feel the sun on your skin, or the rain and on your back, or the chill of the winter air, but you become much more closely connected to the world and the landscape around you. And it's this disconnect that is creating so many ills in the world. It's one of the reasons why there is so much anxiety and people are so concerned about what we're doing to this planet, because we've become disconnected. When we buy that new product, when we buy that new toy, when we replace that new piece of technology, it's almost invisible the impact the production of that had on the planet, because we just get the new thing and we discard the old one. It's often referred to as planned obsolescence, and that basically means something has been created with the knowledge that within 6 months it will no longer be up to date. It will no longer be in fashion.
That's
it will
such
no
a
longer
word,
be,
isn't it?
I know. It's actually called planned obsolescence. So a lot of products are actually made and manufactured with the knowledge that within 6 months people will throw them away, and this fast fashion is included in that, where people spend literally nothing on. You can buy a T-shirt for 50p. Now, that might sound like a great bargain, but it hasn't been made for longevity. It's been made with the assumption that within a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of wears, you'll then have to throw it away. And what you must remember is what then happens to all of those products, the fashions, the technology, the cars, whatever it is, are all left. And what we need to do is change the system. And you guys, because you are young and enthusiastic and you are inheriting this world, are the ones who are going to be able to really make a difference. You're the ones that can go and tell mum and dad, you can tell grandma and grandpa and auntie and uncle that they need to be more considerate about our consumption. And together we can start to change the problems that we've created, and we can make those changes.
Very quickly and lastly, you've touched on it there. I think one of the things we're realising is the dangers of the globalisation we have at the moment, how that's affecting the environment. You know, we rapidly use things from all over the world without really any thought as to how we got them, the air miles that spent taking us here. Mm-hmm. You, as an adventurer, made your name for your self-sufficiency. If you were going to give us, away from walking and being green, if you were going to give us, say, three quick tips for being self-sufficient and helping the environment at home, what would they be?
Well, let's broaden it a bit from just, because self-sufficiency literally means you set up in your garden, you start growing your own tomatoes and potatoes, which is I can't recommend that enough. We do that in our house. The kids grow their tomatoes every summer. We plant a number of vegetables. We live in a city, so we only have a small little veg patch. But that's one way of doing it. And that's what you'd call self-sufficient. That basically means you are growing your own produce. Now, it would be very hard to do that for all of your food. But what you can also do is when you go to the supermarket, just have a look. When you buy your fruit or veg that you can't grow yourself, just have a look on the container at where it came from. Now, if it's an apple, we in this country grow the greatest selection of apples in the whole world. We are, if there was one fruit that defined Great Britain, it is the apple. There are hundreds of varieties, and our climate is perfect for them. But more often than not, you'll go into a supermarket and most of those apples will come from far away countries with huge food miles. So what I'd recommend first of all is just buy food that is grown in this country. You're supporting British farmers. The air miles are going to be much lower. And that also means buying food in season. So just because you love raspberries doesn't mean you should eat them in the winter. Now, you can, because those raspberries might have been imported from other countries. But I think you need to be sensible about what we eat and when we eat it. So those are two things. Grow your own veg, look at the provenance of the veg, and then obviously we have a huge problem with the packaging, the over-packaging of a lot of our produce. Bananas don't need to be sold wrapped in plastic. Bananas have a perfectly good organic wrapping, which is yellow, which is really convenient because it looks like a banana. And in fact, it is part of the banana. It's the skin of a banana that comes with a natural packaging. So the second thing is to try and think about the amount of packaging on those products. And with just those few tiny little changes to your lifestyle, you can actually have a positive impact, a positive negative impact.
Amazing. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the
Pleasure.
Science Weekly and telling us more.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
Right, this week, our Dangerous Dan is all about one of the most commonly grown plants that's also one of the most deadly. Oleander has pink leaves, and it's toxic in pretty much all of its parts. And it's grown around the world. In fact, it's so widely grown that no one actually really knows where it comes from, where the original oleander bloomed. Now, people even think that its name, Oleander, comes from an ancient Greek word that means I kill men. Ah, oh, devastating. Now, in America, oddly, the oleanders are quite often found in school gardens. Seems an odd idea. I don't really know why you would do that. The thing with the oleander, it doesn't really kill you, but it does affect almost every part of the inside of your body. You'll be sick. It'll affect your blood. It will make your heart beat strangely, you'll get pale, you'll get cold, you may even have tremors and seizures and collapse. And that's if you eat it. Just by touching the sap can cause blotchy swelling. You'll go red everywhere, you'll get itching as well. And one issue with it too, that you don't really think about, eating honey that has been made from bees who have eaten the oleander can be toxic to you as well. So you kind of need to be aware of this deadly, dangerous, but secretive plant that surprisingly is everywhere. It can really do you in without you even knowing about it. It's the oleander, and it absolutely makes our dangerous Dan list. It's time for another one of our faves on the Science Weekly. She is a gadget guru. She's an absolute genius. She's here to answer all of your tech questions, anything about computers, about security, about the internet, about satellites, all of that stuff. She is here to sort us out. Her name is Techno Mum.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology.
Welcome back to Tech Trivia, the game show that tests the technical talents of our tremendous contestants. And playing this week, it's Techno Mum!
Hi, good to be back. I'm raring to go.
Now, you got a record score last time. Let's see if you can top that today. So come on and spin the wheel! And today's category is... cost. Your time starts now. Your first question. Why is cost important in technology?
Well, how much things cost is important to pretty much everyone. If you get pocket money, you'll be used to thinking about cost. Things like, have I got enough pennies? Is what I want cheaper in a different shop? The point is, making things uses resources. That's, well, stuff. And stuff costs, you got it, money. And the more it costs to make, the higher the prices will be in the shop. And when you're shopping and there are two similar items, chances are you'll go for the cheaper one. So if you're making a new product, you need to make sure the price isn't going to put people off. But you also need to remember that products have a job to do. Scrimp on your materials and it could all go wrong if your product breaks. Cost can be a problem if you only want to make a small amount of anything, or if you want to make each one unique. Whilst you can buy a poster of your favourite footballer or a pop star fairly cheaply, they print large batches out at any one time, if you wanted someone to paint you a portrait, well, that's going to take longer and cost a lot more. And this causes a lot of headaches for people who make prototypes. Prototypes are like the first samples of a new product. They're normally completely unique, and that means, yep, more costly. But without prototypes, you may find that products aren't made at all.
Budget-busting answers there, Techno Mum. Okay, next question. Name a cool innovation that's helped engineers keep costs down.
Oh yes, the 3D printer. These can help make one-off, unique items extremely cheaply. And you don't need a lab, you can even get them for your home. It's a way of making three-dimensional objects from a digital computer file. Layers of a special plastic are laid down to create the object. They're now being used in medicine and space exploration.
Last question, name a cool career that's all about cost.
Oh gosh, well, what about a materials engineer? They check out different materials to see how well they'll do the job. And the coolest thing of all is that they might even invent something totally new. Materials engineers are super important in getting the best, most cost-effective materials for new inventions.
I have to stop you there. Priceless performance. You're through to the next round, Techno Mum.
Great, although I think I need to spend a penny now.
Techno Mum's Tech Trivia with the Institution of Engineering Technology. Find out more at funkidslive.com/tech-trivia.
How do you fancy having a look at all the science that has been fluttering around your news this week? Quite a lot to say, by the way. That is a tongue twister. Right, anyway, the sun's surface has been seen at a detail never before known. A telescope in Hawaii zoomed in and took a video of the surface of the sun writhing and bubbling away. It managed to capture cells, complete cells, that's what they think they are, and some are the size of Texas, which I think might be the biggest state in America. It's in the top three anyway. That's how big these cells on top of the sun are. They show bright centres of the cells that get really hot in the middle where the plasma burns, and then they're dark around the edge where it gets cooler. Also, archaeologists are planning an ambitious survey off a part of a seabed off the coast of Jersey. Neanderthals once lived there, and the site is exposed during low tide in the spring. It gives the team a four-hour window to dig while the sea is out. They need to dig, they need to find out everything they can know about the Neanderthals, and then when the sea comes back in, they need to quickly leg it, and hopefully they'll learn loads more about our prehistoric cousins. And finally, experts have said two satellites hurtling across the sky at nearly 33,000 miles an hour narrowly missed colliding over America last week. They say that they crossed without incident at 20-7. They were 550 miles above America, and experts predict that the satellites could actually pass within 12 metres of each other, but these ones aren't in use. But they were worried that if the satellites crashed over Pennsylvania, debris would hit other things in space, things that they actually use, and they would damage those. And that is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Remember, if you've got any science question that you want answered on this show, send it my way. I will do all the work. Either I'll research it myself, or I'll get like a proper genius in that field to come on and explain it all for you. Last week on the show, we had Libby Jackson, who works for the UK Space Agency. She took time out of her just like ludicrously busy day to come and talk to us about how gravity works. So these things can be done. You just need to fire it over as a review for the show over on the Apple Podcast Store. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, please. While you're on that podcast store, it's one of the ways you can hear all our fantastic science series. You can get them there. You can also get them on Google, on Spotify. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com as well. And Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can find us all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, at funkidslive.com.